we have four speakers this morning, and I thought we would go through the presentations and then have some discussion at the end. So I'd invite you to jot down your notes and questions, and we'll make sure that we keep to time so that we can have some conversation as well. I think the session this morning will be really interesting. Two papers to start with, which will give us a bit of a sense of case studies almost, if you like, around in-country on the ground, followed up by two papers that we'll be looking at the M&E evaluation side of things. So lots for us to discuss, no doubt. And I did want to mention as well, as one of my panellists did, that it's really nice to be part of an all-female panel. That's never happened to me before. I'm not sure if it's something just unique to this conference, but certainly welcomed by the planning committee. So I will thank them for their efforts in balance and the conversations that have happened yesterday and no doubt today. Lastly, congratulations on being here, 8 a.m. from the start. Nothing like the enthusiasm of a sector coming together early in the morning. So I do hope you have the chance to throw a coffee or tea or we'll start after. So kicking off this morning, Sharon Mell is a PhD candidate at Massey University in New Zealand. Her research includes health system development and conflict-affected areas, complexity in development, global aid architecture, and new actors in development, gender and peace. Her current PhD work explores the approaches used by international non-government organisations in partnership with non-state armed groups in Myanmar. So she will talk us through that this morning. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. Kia ora koutou and mai sung ka. I'm Sharon, I'm from New Zealand, but please indulge me a little bit of this place. I lived in Wagga Wagga for 18 months as a preschooler, so I'm going to claim that today, if that's okay with you. As we do in Aotearoa, New Zealand, I would also like to acknowledge the tangata whenua, or the people of this place, the people of the Ngunnawal tribe, and thank them and their elders for allowing me to be in this beautiful place today. And as always, I will honour my research participants in Myanmar as well. Right, so today I'm sharing findings from my PhD fieldwork that I conducted in a Shan or Dai community on the Thai-Myanmar border in 2015 and 2016. So my research aims to understand the approaches that an international non-governmental organisation uses in partnership with a non-state armed group, which I'll refer to as an NSAG, to develop ethnic health system capacity in Shan State, Myanmar, through a medic training program that they run there. The research addresses a gap in understanding what health system development currently looks like in Shan State, which is a continued locus of conflict between the Myanmar military and various NSAGs in that place. And I'll offer three main points about the possibilities for transformation of the ethnic health system through the partnership between the INGO and the NSAG. I genuinely welcome your feedback and questions because I'm still thinking through my conclusions at this stage. In March of 2005, I had my third child. It was a relatively easy labour. But once he arrived, it was clear that all was not well. He was purple and floppy and unresponsive. And we'd chosen to have a hospital birth, so our midwife reached over and pushed this big red button on the wall. And within about 30 seconds, the room was filled with specialist doctors and nurses who resuscitated him and whisked him away to the special care baby unit. 3 days later, we took him home, and he's now a happy, healthy, nearly 12-year-old. In March of last year, I witnessed my first birth that was not one of my own. I was invited into the delivery room of the Border Health Clinic by one of the Dai medics, where a surprise twin was struggling to arrive. One of the two New Zealand doctors who run the medic training program was struggling to get her out. He succeeded, but had to resuscitate her. And the manager of that border clinic decided it was best to evacuate her and her family, along with the two Kiwi doctors, out from the border to the nearest Thai cottage hospital. So they endured the two-hour drive over awful four-wheel drive roads that we use, and the doctors there referred her on to an even larger Thai hospital. A week later, the doctors there decided there was nothing they could do for this baby, so they sent her back to this community, and she died peacefully on that rough journey home. So in that situation, there just was no big red button for those medics to push for expert help. And the situation is much worse in rural communities inside Shan State, and there are unacceptably high rates of infant and maternal mortality. That photo is of her healthy twin sister who arrived first. So I'll just give you a little bit of context about where my research takes place, where the twins were born. So Myanmar's endured over 60 years of conflict between the state and various armed groups. And during that time, the state has failed to provide health care, and this has led to poor health outcomes, especially in conflict-affected areas. So health system development in these types of contexts has received attention on the ways in which INGOs build the capacity of the state. So less is known about what it looks like when INGOs engage with NSAGs and the possibilities for transformation these relationships might offer. So I'm looking at a small INGO that runs different development programs throughout Myanmar. So my case study is the medic training program that they run. So young Dai people come from inside Shan State, above that big red arrow, to the border, and they live there for 8 months where they're trained as either community health workers or medics before they return to their rural communities. So the red arrow is the approximate location on the Thai-Myanmar border. So my story illustrates there's a very real need for the capacity of the Dai health system to be developed so they're able to provide a level of healthcare where there is literally none. And my first major theme looks at how the INGO conducts this medic training program to build that capacity. And I found that despite engaging the capabilities of the medics in many ways, real transformation has been limited by the technocratic and top-down approach of the expat doctors. A little more context. Most of these medics have received very little formal schooling. Some have received no schooling at all, and they do really well to function in that border clinic in many ways like junior doctors in New Zealand. Some even end up performing minor surgery. But the training medics become quite alienated by this highly technical Western context resources. So I think the INGO could engage with medic capabilities more effectively in three ways. First, they should have translated the training resources into the Dai language at the start of the program in 2009. They only just started to do this last year. Secondly, they could utilise training resources that have been developed by other INGOs, that are best practice in these low-resource, low-education contexts. There's no need for them to reinvent the wheel, as they do. And thirdly, the INGO itself could select and prepare its expatriate medical volunteers more appropriately on the basis for their ability in this context rather than simply their availability. And my second finding focuses on that partnership between the INGO and the NSAG. So global experience of working in these conflict-affected and post-conflict societies focuses on how INGOs work with states to increase their legitimacy and their capacity to provide services to their people. So these kind of parallel systems are seen as a real negative. But the process of cooperating with the state in Myanmar is complex. Conflict is still ongoing in many parts of Myanmar. There are very high levels of distrust in the government. And the role of the Myanmar military itself as a separate entity from the government is very complicated in these conflict-affected areas. It just makes it really difficult. So actually, any improvements in healthcare in these conflict-affected areas is going to be very slow to come. So I argue that it is a legitimate approach for the INGO to partner with the NSAG that controls areas of the ethnic state. And it ensures that this ethnic health system reaches populations that the government system simply doesn't. The approach also supports ethnic desires to see the health system decentralised into their control and management rather than converging with the Myanmar Ministry of Health system. As you might imagine, partnering with an NSAG is not a perfect solution. There are many negatives to trying to establish a civilian health system within the parameters of those military structures. But I've concluded it's better than these rural communities receiving no health care at all. So finally, my last finding focuses on a major shift that has taken place in international funding away from that cross-border work with ethnic civil society organisations to working more with the Myanmar government. This has jeopardised the capacity development of many ethnic CSOs. So since the Myanmar government made tentative changes toward democracy in 2011, the international community seems to have shifted more to work with state organisations and NGOs working inside Myanmar, not in areas controlled by NSAGs. So the ethnic CSOs that are working in these conflict-affected areas and doing that cross-border work have had their funding dramatically reduced. They see that reduction in funding and support as premature while the military is still engaged in conflict in many areas, including violation of human rights. So the Dai CSO engaged in this medic training has had to cut the monitoring of its own health clinics, so it's less able to evaluate its own health system development. And other meaningful activities to build CSO capacity in health and education systems have just ended due to this cut in funding. And in this new environment, it's also difficult for the INGO to access donor funding, but the ethnic CSOs still require this direct support from the international community. And the bonus of that approach in partnering with these ethnic groups and increasing their capacity is it actually gives them greater equality at the peace process table. So my papers discuss these three incipient conclusions about a way forward for ethnic health system development in Shan State. So there needs to be a way for those medics to provide that big red button for their communities and in fact reduce the need for that big red button in the first place. And this is especially so in a context still affected by conflict between the military and NSAGs. So first, the emergent ethnic health system can only be improved by the INGO providing more suitable and prepared volunteers and context-specific teaching methods and resources that reflect best global practice. Secondly, the partnership between the INGO and the NSAG provides a legitimate hybrid way forward until the Dai can establish a fully civilian health system. And last, the INGO has to operate in this global context where the international community has shifted its funding. So while this particular INGO supports ethnic desires to develop an appropriate Dai health system, I consider there still remains possibilities for transformation and, in fact, a good chance of that big red button being available to communities. So thank you for letting me share a little bit of my research, and I really do welcome your comments and questions at the end. So kia ora koutou.
Thank you very much. perfect start to our session this morning, which I think I really appreciate storytelling. I think that's certainly a way that we can learn from each other, and it's so powerful to hear your research, and particularly in the stories. Our next speaker is Liz McKinnon, and Liz is the CEO of Australian Doctors International. They are a non-government development organisation formed by a group of people working for a healthier Papua New Guinea. Liz is a board director for Mary's House as well, which is a Sydney Women and Children's Shelter, I understand.
Yes.
And a reality learning and Australian enterprise delivering online education programs to organisations throughout the Pacific. She's a specialist in gender equity, reducing violence against women and children. Welcome.
Thank you. Great. This morning as I was starting, I was thinking, who draws the short straw to get 8 o'clock in the morning? But then I realised, actually, this is great, because only people that are truly keen are here. So listen, Australian Doctors International, what I'd like to do, firstly, of course, is to acknowledge our Indigenous brothers and sisters and pay my respects to the elders that looked after this land so beautifully. I'd also like to acknowledge Dr. Clara Henderson. So Clara is the evaluator that has just finished the 5-year evaluation of our New Ireland remote patrols, and also Patrick McCloskey, who was our program manager for Australian Doctors International, who's now gone off to CARE. We still love him dearly. But it was their vision to really stop after 6 years of Australian doctors working in New Ireland in Papua New Guinea to see, does this work? We thought it did, and it's really great to be able to present to you our findings about the evaluation. So as I get into it, to start with, in Papua New Guinea, these are statistics that anyone that is associated with Papua New Guinea knows. 85% of people live rural and remote. The problem that we have when we look at the health statistics in Papua New Guinea is that 80% of health investment doesn't go rural and remote. It goes into urban and regional centres, and it's predominantly taken up into the hospital system. What we see is that there are just over 400 trained medical specialists in Papua New Guinea, Papua New Guineans that have gone through either the University of Papua New Guinea or through a training system here. Of that, there are only 5 rural and remote specialists. So these are medical doctors that have specialised in rural and remote. Now, none of them are located in New Ireland. So we have a mismatch between where the population in Papua New Guinea is and what the service delivery, the health system investment is. So the question that ADI was asked 5 years ago, 6 years ago, was how do you support a provincial health system to trial, design, embed, and then eventually own a rural and remote health system? And what does that look like? And that's where the Australian Doctors International model comes from. We have a model, integrated patrols and in services. Basically what that means is remote healthcare delivery combined with professional development for frontline health staff. So this is one of our doctors, Dr. Denise Wild. This is actually not the patrol. This is an evacuation of a sick child. So they were on patrol. They were a day's hike out of KVN. Child needed to be taken into hospital, and so because we were there, the doctor was there, the boat was there, they were able to actually take the child in. So the integrated patrols reach rural and remote communities. This is not an hour's walk from town. The patrols are doctors going out in boats, going out in troop carriers. They take a multidisciplinary health team with them of Papua New Guineans. So the doctor is simply there as part of the ADI model of showing that there is a way of systematically and with great logistics and care of actually continually providing this healthcare out in rural and remote. So let me move on from that and I'll get into some of the statistics. So you'll see with this graph that we actually see something's just happened. What do you think? It's like being in Papua New Guinea. Anyway, I'll just keep talking. I can see that.
Sorry.
So we go rural and remote, and the key requirement for an Australian doctor patrol. That's all going.
Sorry.
That's great. Low resource setting. Get to every part. Okay, so with the multidisciplinary teams that go out, basically the model is Australian doctors say we will send a volunteer Australian doctor and their partner. Now, we really encourage that their partner goes with them, because over the years we've realised that it makes it a heck of a better placement for the doctor, but it's also, it increases the scope of what we can offer as a volunteer deployment. So, for example, I sent a cardiologist into Western Province the last 6 months of last year, and his partner was a clinical nurse educator. And at the end of the 6 months, they both said she was far more important than he was. And I really loved that, because I thought, great, we've deployed this young couple, they've had a life-changing experience, but they brought their professionalism to it. So the key bit with the model, as we seamlessly segue back, is that it is multidisciplinary. And I love this, it's a bit hard to see, but on all of our patrols, we have a dental technician. Now, having worked in Indigenous Australia, having worked in rural and remote all around the world, nobody sees a dentist. Whereas we take a dentist on every patrol. So they're out there seeing the oral cancers. They're out there seeing, you know, the primary extractions that need to happen so that you're not getting that terrible oral health happening. So on every patrol, we take as varied a mix of Papua New Guinea health staff as we can. Because of, and I think this is, there's a couple of unique parts of our model. One is this is a true partnership with provincial health. So provincial health pay for half of the whole program. They also are responsible for all the logistics. They're responsible for releasing the Papua New Guinean staff to come on patrol. They're responsible for the follow-up, the referral, and the data collection. So this isn't an INGO coming in and saying, we're going to do it for you, or we're going to bring a lot of money and we're going to know how to do this and it's going to be something that we bolt on. This is a true partnership. From the beginning, we've said we won't be here forever. And what we're trying to do is work with New Ireland Provincial Health to say, this is going to be your health system. And we can demonstrate that it's both feasible, that it gets outcomes, and that the rural and remote people that are living in the villages, nowhere near aid posts and health centres, actually really benefit from this. And the feedback that we continually get is, we haven't seen a doctor in 12 months. We haven't seen a we took a Papua New Guinean doctor from Kavieng Hospital on a couple of the patrols last year, and one lovely older fellow in a village said, I've never met a Papua New Guinean doctor before. And he was in his 60s. So it's a lovely way of demonstrating something that here in Australia and in other countries we know is really effective. You can deliver multidisciplinary services, rural and remote. And we're demonstrating that in Papua New Guinea in partnership with New Ireland Provincial Health. I lost track of time there, Julianne. How am I doing?
Doing
well. Okay. So, look, in terms of the patrols, we're averaging about 140 service days a year. The patrols are going out each location 1 to 2 days. The doctor sees, the Australian doctor does see a number of patients, but the way that it runs is, patrol goes into a village, whether it's a health or an aid post. Everyone is there, but it's two Papua New Guinean patrol team leader and their offsider who do all the screening. So basically they're triaging. They're triaging to see, is this person, should they see the Australian doctor? And hopefully 9 times out of 10, it's no. They're going off to the Papua New Guinean team, whether it's eye health, whether it's dental, whether it's maternal child health, or it's communicable diseases. they're seen. What the doctor does mainly is case-based training during the clinic. So they're there, they're working with the Papua New Guinean staff doing on-the-ground training around what's happening. At night, there's a debrief and a case-based review as well, often led by the Papua New Guinean staff. So they're talking through, these are the cases, this is what we've done, what would you do differently? And the doctor and their partner, if they're on patrol, are talking through that. The other significant part of the model that I haven't spent much time on is we run two in-services every year in New Ireland. We determine the topic from conversation with the patrol team. So patrol team says, actually, at the moment it's maternal child health. Our health workers, our aid post workers haven't had any training in the latest family planning or the latest child health. What we've seen in just the last 3 years is we've trained 80% of the rural and remote health workers in New Ireland. That's significant. These are workers that have... The last training they got was when they graduated. So they're nurses coming out of Lemmecott Nursing School probably 20 years ago, and then they have training through ADI. We partner on those trainings. So, for instance, the November maternal child health training that Australian doctors did was with Burnett. In Western Province, it was with Murray Stopes. We did some work with Fred Hollows around eye health as well. So we don't pretend to be, you know, the greatest fount of all knowledge of all health conditions, but what we are is week in, week out, on patrol in New Ireland. We have the relationship with the government, we have the teams, we have the rhythm going within the health system itself, and we can bring partners in as needed and as identified by both the communities and the workers. We have a lot of information, obviously, about what training and who attended. And if anybody wants that level of detail, they can come chat to me afterwards. So what I like about this model, and I've worked in international development for 20 years, I guess, in lots of different scenarios, it is a very defined, replicable model. It's about partnering with the health system, bringing in that extra catalyst that it can actually just change the conversation to say, we've got a methodology here, we don't own it, we're not owning this process, we're not bringing a team of Australian doctors with all the multidisciplinary coming in, and we're there logically in it on a week in, week out basis. And one of the nice things that, you know, the health economists look at, and Dr. Clara Henderson is a health economist, the average cost of an examination by an ADI doctor is 22 kina. That's just under $10. So it is a very cost-effective model. One of the other parts that I really appreciate is we only send experienced Australian doctors. So they have to have completed all of their medical training, have 4 years post-training experience. They do get, we have a clinical governance group that they're able to connect with, so if they get those tricky cases, the things that they don't know what to do with, they can call back into Australia to get advice from a group of people that have lived and worked and had their boots on the ground in Papua New Guinea and can really help them with that. Some of the specialists like Dr. Bernie Hudson from Royal North Shore and the microbiology department, they're people that have come around the ADI model and said, we'd really like to support the doctors to be successful in their six-month deployment. So our evaluation, we have a number of things that we need to do. All of them are fairly straightforward. One of the things that strikes me about this model, and I've been with Australian doctors for about 6 months, is we know that multidisciplinary integrated service delivery gets you great outcomes. We know that from our rural and remote work here in Australia. And so it's a great thing to be able to see it working in Papua New Guinea, embedded within a health system. And it's been great to be able to talk to you today about how Australian Doctors is working out there on the front line, trying to strengthen the Papua New Guinean health system, particularly in New Ireland. So thank you for your time and your patience with our low resource set today. Thank you.
It strikes me, I know that our speakers didn't collaborate on their presentations this morning, but already we have this lovely theme that's coming out. And I think, you know, what I've certainly heard from our first two papers is this idea that context is key, where you're working, the idea that training and capacity development must go hand in hand, looking at the systems, and then, of course, working in partnership. And I think both our presenters this morning were talking about it's not ours, we don't own this, we're building, you know, systems with people. And they're not our system. So, you know, understanding that from a context point of view is really key. So, thank you very much. We'll move straight on to our third presentation, which is Professor Maxine Whittaker, who joins us from James Cook University. Professor Whittaker has a wealth of experience in global and tropical health, and she's lived in and worked in Bangladesh, Zambia, Zimbabwe, New Guinea, and that's only the start of a long list of countries, I think, where the experience that Maxine has worked. She has experience in sexual and reproductive health and gender analysis, another theme coming across our speakers this morning. So thank you very much for being
here. Thanks, Julianne. Thank you and good morning. Today's paper draws upon some lessons learned from successful infectious disease control programs, diseases that have been prioritised globally. I've based it on a lot of reading, and the evaluations I'll show you, the vignettes are based on published literature, but also personal reflections, as I think you can hear I can have the luxury of doing, and discussions with the JCU colleagues that have been involved in the vignettes I'll talk about. I'm not going to discuss the epidemiological or health system outcomes of these, but really look at the architecture of the support, and again, continuing the theme we've been discussing both yesterday and today. But before I move on, I too wish to acknowledge the traditional landowners of the land on which we are meeting and pay respects to their elders, past, present, and the future leaders. In 2006, at the beginning of an Australian PNG-funded health program focusing on capacity building, a joint workshop was held involving government, church, non-government organisations, provincial and national PNG and program staff. It focused on developing a jointly owned way of doing business to achieve a shared vision based on the GOPNG National Health Plan. At one point, language and titles to be used was raised, but just realised that the automatic timing has stayed on. So let me just turn that off. Sorry about that. Get rid of timing. Sorry. Okay, cool. Sorry about that. That's what happens when you practice in your hotel room late at night. Was based on the GOPNG National Health Plan. At one point, what language and titles to be used was raised. Several words were suggested anonymously and some nominal group processes were done. And the one that you've already had the curtain call on, the one that came up was preferred by the Government of Papua New Guinea staff was MATES. They didn't want the terms advisors, experts, beneficiaries, but they really wanted to think about how to be mates. So I've turned this into an acronym to summarise the lessons learnt that I'll now expose through some of the vignettes and the literature. And yesterday we had some speakers talking about mechanisms of success, and I think this adds to those discussions. So I'll come to these at the end. Now I'll just go to three case studies or three vignettes. The first I want to talk about is ATMEN. ATMEN was established in February 2009, the Asia Pacific Malaria Elimination Network. It was funded by DFAT and Bill and Melinda Gates fund through the University of California, San Francisco's Global Health Group. There were 10 founding countries, you can see in the white ones on this slide, who had declared elimination of malaria as their national target. And although malaria elimination now may sound a very accepted norm in global lexicon, back in 2009, and one of the reasons this network was formed, was at that stage people thought it was mission impossible, but these were countries that wanted to do it. And they were also frustrated that people, the global architecture and the global resources available were not helping them reach that goal. And so they wanted something that would help them along that way. This was also joined by scientific, academic and public health organisations, public and private sector and multilaterals. By 2015, when this one was done, you'll see that all 18 Asia-Pacific countries had declared that they were pursuing malaria elimination, and more than 30 partner institutions were members. And it's recently had its secretariat moved to co-locate with the Asia-Pacific Leaders Malaria Alliance in Singapore, and our chair here today, Julianne, is actually one of the board members of APLMA. The architecture identified to evolve and evaluate this network as an ongoing process by the members of the network was based on a definition of network. And the key performance indicators that were used to evaluate it were based on this and some frameworks that came out of using this. So the key words here, networking defined as a process framework, so something that's flexible and adaptive, for empowering stakeholders not only to share and apply new knowledge, but also to identify and prioritise problems systematically and to participate in the development of appropriate solutions. There's that participation word again. This was evaluated... This was evaluated several times using both internal and external evaluations and mixed methods. And what people said was that the successes of it from an organisational point of view and what they valued are the following. This self-driven, supporting work collectively, working around a shared vision and having a sense of ownership of the network. That the way the network worked and operated built confidence and motivation. Decision making was transparent. There was an action orientation to it. So yesterday one of the speakers talked about having outcomes early, and that action orientation was something that was key to all people, country partners, partner institutions, funding and development agencies involved in the network. That it had value for all partners. It was transparency in the decision making, and that they shared and learned from each other, and there was joint building of the evidence base. The second vignette I want to talk about is PACELF, and that's the Pacific Elimination of Emphatic Filariasis Network. This just shows you quickly where the countries are that have lymphatic filariasis in the Pacific. In 1999, WHO launched the PACELF as a Pacific arm of the global program, which aims to eliminate lymphatic filariasis as a public health problem by 2020. So 2030 for eliminating malaria in Asia-Pacific, 2020 for LF. The Pacific program is coordinated by WHO professional staff in the office of the WHO rep for the South Pacific and Suva Fiji. They talk about the PACELF way, which you can see disappearing off the screen there, which was developed by 16 countries and 6 partners. So those 16 countries on the map, the 6 partners were the Australian and Japanese development programs, CDC in the US, Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine, GSK, GlaxoSmithKline, the pharmaceutical company that also provides the medications involved in it. What's the PACELF way? The PACELF way was modelled on a Japanese model of community-driven self-help approach. It was developed to be a regional collaborative approach that were seen as benefit to the entire family. Based on that self-help approach, it also had a lot of operational flexibility, including customised health promotion, community engagement. They chose their own ways and evaluated their own ways to do mass drug administration. The package was a simple core package of activities, didn't try to load it with too much other stuff, and there was a very effective coordination and integration of this into the existing health services, which we've heard earlier. A very cohesive participation and teamwork approach, not only with those partners in the countries I mentioned, but within countries with clinicians, scientists, public health workers, women and other civil society groups and program managers. And their focus was on long-term outcomes, positive outcomes. In both of these so far, there was also that sense of a long-term commitment, that this is not something that happens overnight, but we all need to be in this together for the long haul. The third vignette is the Oitifi Health Research Group in Malaita, Solomon Islands. And before I go into the model, I want to note and acknowledge the sad passing of Rick Spear, who is one of the people I'll mention in this vignette, who actually helped set up this approach. And there is a bursary and funding that allows some of this work to continue for the folk in Oitifi. This was initiated by Solomon Islanders when some JCU researchers visited them. The Solomon Islanders said they were unhappy with their previous experiences of research, and that they found the trickle-down approach of change that happened in Honiara through all these aid programs wasn't getting to them in the remote rural parts of Malaita. They wanted a different way to do business, and they had a self-expressed desire to learn how to do research and have that research focus on their own needs. There was a recognition by all who participated and still participate in this model, folk in Oitifi, in the communities, in the health service, and the JCU staff and student placements who go there, that this is mutual learning for action. Community people are actively involved and inform the research questions. So make sure there's socially, culturally appropriate ways of doing the implementation research and a part of finding the solutions. And again, a long-term commitment. One of the articles that has evaluated this identified, again, many of these are the things you've already heard from the other two vignettes and our other speakers, is that it was something, a participatory approach, there was action, it was mutual learning, and some of the researchers from JCU and other organisations globally that go there comment about also what they've learnt in being part of this. They've learnt different ways of doing research, and they've learnt better ways of identifying solutions, and those recommendations that they put in their papers that are jointly published with the health researchers in Oitifi are so much stronger for that. A conclusion of one of the papers around this noted that given different social, cultural, economic, geographic, spiritual and service contexts across the Pacific, locally appropriate approaches need to be considered. Such approaches challenge the orthodox approach of centralised investment to replicate specialist-driven models of funder nations. Increasing expertise at all levels through participatory capacity-building models that define and address local problems may be more sustainable and responsive to local health needs and concerns. And this model is being used to look at mental health contexts at the moment. So it's a living way of doing business. So let's come back to our mates, what I think are the things that I drew from the readings, personal reflections, talking to my colleagues and reading these evaluations. All of them talk about mutual learning and benefit, and that this mutual learning is embedded in the DNA of those approaches. That it recognises not just capacities, but a word that I'm reflecting on from yesterday a lot, the capabilities of people on all sides and using those and being open to learning, mutual learning. The issue about adaptation, having the flexibility to adapt what are good practices, but adapting them to the context, informed by implementation research, so I suppose that's something I've added to the discussions today, the role of having capacity to learn by doing, but doing it with some research framing, not big R, but implementation research, and being bold enough to right-size the interventions to the context in which you're working. Teamwork and trust is very important. That's been built upon respect and constant continuous dialogue. Engagement and collaboration of all providers and of all resources available. The people resources, the local resources, the traditional knowledges and wisdoms. And that this is leading to sustainable ways of doing business. It may take a bit longer sometimes because these things have to evolve, but all of these are models of things that are continuing as frameworks to do work on some of these global health issues. Other evaluations have also identified many of these. For example, End Poverty by 2015 evaluation has a series of vignettes that also highlight similar issues. So thank you for your time, and I just want to acknowledge those JCU colleagues that have been involved in this. We're happy to have some in-depth discussions with me, and our partners in Asia and Pacific who have participated in, mutually helped us learn different ways of doing business, and continue to contribute their knowledge and experiences. Thank you.
Might come back to the concept of mains at the end and discuss that a little bit more. Just strikes me that it would be interesting to hear from people's experiences in the room and some elements of that makes are more critical than others, whether some have to come on board first, and which of those areas is the most challenging to get right or to develop. Our next speaker is Irene Wetton Hall, and it's my pleasure to introduce a colleague of mine who is also from Foreign Affairs and Trade, working in the Office of Development and Effectiveness. Irene has over 30 years' experience working on the AID program. She's posted to Nairobi, Harare, Beijing, and Port Moresby. And she's here this morning to talk about a recent evaluation of Australia's assistance in pandemic and emerging infectious diseases. Thanks, Irene.
Oh, good morning, everybody. Well, I've really enjoyed hearing the previous presentations this morning, the two case studies, which remind us that health system strengthening is really about people. I also enjoyed Maxine's reflections on lessons from efforts to control specific diseases in Asia and the Pacific. I think it's quite fitting that my presentation comes at the end, as it is more at the systems level, dare I say, somewhat more disembodied level. But it's very much trying to put all the pieces of the jigsaw together and identify some long-term outcomes in strengthening health systems. So today, I wanted to take the opportunity on behalf of the Office of Development Effectiveness in DFAT to present an overview of a current evaluation, a current strategic evaluation we have commissioned. And I'd like to acknowledge that our evaluation team leader, Dr. Jill Scarehood from the Kirby Institute, University of New South Wales, is with us today. So the central question for the evaluation is, are human and animal health systems in Asia and the Pacific stronger as a result of Australia's investments in combating emerging infectious diseases over the last decade? The answer is, in some respects, yes, but there are continuing gaps and challenges. I emphasise that these are preliminary and emerging findings which have not yet been finalised. We expect the report to be published on DFAT's website in May, June of this year. So the context for the evaluation is that following the outbreaks of SARS in 2003 and avian influenza in 2004, the Australian government invested around $196.5 million to combat emerging infectious diseases. There were grave concerns about the socio-economic impacts of a potential pandemic influenza. Around 75% of emerging infectious diseases are zoonotic, that is, animal diseases which can infect humans, some of which have potential to mutate to human-to-human transmission. Thus, Australia's investments targeted both human and animal health, with around 39% spent on human health, 35% on animal health, and about 21% on investments which targeted both. And the assistance was largely in the form of capacity building and technical assistance. Investments over the 10 years were guided by two strategies, with a progression over time from the initial emergency response to avian influenza to a greater focus on health system strengthening. In fact, a 2009 review of the first strategy had identified the avian influenza response had unmasked critical needs for health systems development. There was also greater recognition over time of the need for community engagement on disease prevention and to address the gender dimensions of disease vulnerability. The second strategy also included the One Health principle of promoting greater collaboration between animal and human health sectors. Post-Ebola, international concern about the risks and socio-economic impacts of emerging diseases and the need for stronger, more resilient public health systems has deepened. The recent Ebola crisis has shown that when health systems fail, the unchecked spread of infectious diseases across borders can be catastrophic. This is reflected in DFAT's current Health for Development strategy, which recognises the strength of each country's health system in a region collectively determines that region's public health security. A region will only be as strong as its weakest link. The evaluation was commissioned by ODE to strengthen the evidence base on how to strengthen human and animal health systems to prevent, detect and respond to emerging infectious disease threats in Asia and the Pacific. A further purpose is to inform decision making about future DFAT investments and policy engagement on regional health security. The evaluation covers 35 investments in Asia and the Pacific. It doesn't include investments in communicable diseases which receive separate funding, such as HIV, malaria and TB, or immunisation. Foot and mouth disease is included because although it's not a zoonosis, the foot and mouth disease programs include system strengthening work which is essential for the control of other diseases. So thus this evaluation is covering a part of the regional health security agenda, but not all of it. Our main focus is the 10 largest groups of investments, with field work in three places: the Pacific in Fiji and Solomon Islands, the Mekong in Bangkok and Cambodia, and in Indonesia. So the evaluation has been conducted at the whole of portfolio level, not at the level of individual investments. But it does include implementation characteristics which contribute to effectiveness. In order to answer the question, are health systems stronger? We've used the six WHO health system building blocks as an organising framework for data collection and analysis across both human and animal health. The international health regulations and the performance of veterinary services evaluation tool have also been key reference points for us. Using this systems approach, data has been collected through a desk and literature review, through extensive consultations in Australia with key partners, and with site visits in the Pacific, Mekong and Indonesia. This slide shows the main investments across the three places of the field work, which I'll just very quickly run through. The Asia-Pacific Strategy for Emerging Diseases, the Pacific Regional Influenza Preparedness Program, the ASEAN Plus 3 Emerging Infectious Diseases Program, the Southeast Asia and China Foot and Mouth Disease Program, the Stop Transboundary Animal Diseases and Zoonoses Program, PREVENT, the CARE Community-Based Avian Influenza Risk Reduction Program, the various Australia-Indonesia Partnership Bilateral Animal and Health Programs, and the World Bank Avian and Human Influenza Facility. This slide shows the main areas of focus of the 10 largest groups of investments, sorted by the size of investments. So just in case you can't see clearly, the areas are disease surveillance, laboratory, health workforce, which was mostly in the area of field epidemiology, leadership and governments, community engagement, and research and evidence. Emergent findings in human health are that across Asia and the Pacific, the strongest results have been in surveillance, followed by leadership and governance. Field epidemiology has been established as a cornerstone of surveillance and response in Southeast Asia. Overall, we've found increased transparency and sharing of data about disease outbreaks between and within countries. Regional emerging infectious disease networks have been established and used in both regions, and there are strengthened quality assurance systems and networks for laboratories in both regions. However, response capacity has not kept pace with data availability, and there are many issues around the use of data. Overall, a major constraint has been the limited integration of the emerging infectious disease investments with broader DFAT health system investments. On the animal health side, emergent findings are that there was a highly variable state of development of animal health systems at the beginning of the investment period. Australia's made a strong contribution to long-term outcomes in Southeast Asia in leadership and governance and in surveillance. A regionally owned model for foot and mouth disease control has been established, with potential for wider application to other diseases. Quality assurance systems have been established in laboratories, but we found no substantial systemic outcomes in quarantine. Training has been provided for vets and para-vets, but there are no clear system outcomes in workforce development. And finally, we found little evidence of system strengthening from the specific emerging infectious disease investments in the Pacific. So to summarise, we've identified five emergent findings across both human and animal health investments. First, that the health system structure and functioning has a strong influence on results achieved through emerging disease investments. Second, the strongest focus of investment and results achieved was in EID surveillance, followed by leadership and governance. There is strengthened regional coordination and transparency, but gaps remain in broader country-level institutional strengthening, particularly human resources and health financing, and also in response capacity. In regards to One Health, there are still many obstacles to full implementation, and it seems that One Health works best when it's focused on specific diseases or issues of joint concern. Just a very quick note about what we've found on community engagement. Certainly that communities have a vital role in prevention of disease and in surveillance and control measures. Good results were achieved during program implementation, but overall, DFAT's investments have struggled to get community engagement institutionalised. And we think there's a need for ongoing public communications on risk reduction between disease outbreaks to maintain public awareness. Gender is a significant factor in EID, emerging infectious disease vulnerability, due to the different roles of women and men in small-scale agriculture and caregiving to sick family members and in healthcare settings. We've found increased attention to gender over time, but starting from a very low base, and that the animal health sector started behind the human health sector in gender awareness. But progress has been made, and we've identified some very good examples of gender analysis and research, but limited evidence of results. The links between the conceptual understanding of gender and program implementation and outcomes still needs to be strengthened. And unfortunately, gender is still seen by many stakeholders at country level as donor-driven. And finally, just to conclude on One Health approaches, we found that inclusion of animal and human health within initiatives does not equal the One Health approach, as activities can still be implemented very separately. There are examples of One Health of activities that have used the One Health approach, but these have not been institutionalised. Coordination isn't easy. The sectors have different jurisdictions and different drivers for development. Livestock production and trade on the animal health side feature prominently, and public health considerations only really come to the front during disease outbreaks. I'll leave it there. We'll be very happy to answer any questions and receive any comments, and our report will be due out mid-year. Thank you very much.